Sherry Mercier is a 28-year-old woman at 37 weeks gestational age who arrived in labor and delivery complaining of right flank pain and uterine contractions. This was her second pregnancy. Her first pregnancy was uneventful and she delivered vaginally at full term. She reported that she started feeling unwell 2 days ago with nausea, anorexia, and vague upper abdominal discomfort. She thought she was getting sick with something. Over the next 24 hours, the pain intensified, became focused in her right flank and right back, and she noticed regular uterine contractions every 10 minutes. She vomited once. Her last bowel movement was before the pain started and was normal. When I arrived to see her, she didn't look well. She was lying on her side in the bed, not moving and not smiling. She had her temperature of 100.6, blood pressure of 110 over 70, pulse of 100, and a respiratory rate of 20. Her pulse oximetry showed 99% saturation on room air. The electronic fetal monitor showed a normal reactive heart rate tracing with a baseline rate of 155. There were no decelerations. She was contracting every 7 to 10 minutes. I examined her. She was tender in the right upper quadrant of her abdomen and also demonstrated significant right flank tenderness. When she coughed, it provoked the pain in her upper right side and back. There was no abdominal guarding, and rebound tenderness was plus-minus. Her uterus was not tender. Her bladder was not tender. Her cervix was closed, 2 centimeters thick, and the fetal head was presenting at -3 station. Based on her presentation, the wise and experienced labor and delivery nurses had already started an IV, sent a CBC and a urine analysis, and held a couple of extra blood tubes in the event I wanted to order some additional blood tests. The CBC showed a white blood count of 14,000 with a left shift in the differential. Her hemoglobin was 13.3 and platelet count of 234,000. The urinalysis had a specific gravity of 1030, large ketones, 1 plus blood, 2 plus white cells, negative leukocyte esterase, and 2 plus epithelial cells. After this initial evaluation, I knew she was sick with something, but it probably was not labor. Women in labor don't usually complain of upper abdominal and flank pain, and they don't look sick. She's clearly dehydrated and ketotic from not eating, as evidenced by her elevated hemoglobin and ketoneuria. Preeclampsia and the HELLP syndrome can present with epigastric pain, but her blood pressure was normal and she had no proteinuria. Renal stones usually cause pain that is more waxing and waning. However, she did have some blood in the urine in a somewhat contaminated specimen. Pyelonephritis does present with upper abdominal and flank pain and can make you look quite ill, but her leukocyte esterase was negative and she had only 2 plus white cells in a contaminated specimen. Nonetheless, pyelo was an attractive possible diagnosis because it would capture the low-grade temperature, mild leukocytosis, flank pain, and reactive uterine contractions. Appendicitis was another attractive diagnosis. The location of the pain is right where the appendix would be at 37 weeks of gestation, and the steady progression of symptoms favored appendicitis. Cholecystitis was another possibility. The incidence of cholecystitis is increased during pregnancy, but the location of the pain and tenderness didn't fit well with this diagnosis. Unlike the appendix, which is pushed up and to the side with the advancing pregnancy, the gallbladder remains in its same normal position, although tucked under the ribs a little bit further because of the rising diaphragm. This is not where her pain seemed to be, although the other symptoms could be explained on the basis of cholecystitis. Pancreatitis also seemed unlikely because of the location of the pain and the absence of protracted vomiting, but this was a consideration. I ordered some additional tests. I wanted a cathed urine specimen for urine analysis. She was sick enough that I wanted a fully cathetered in anyway to accurately record the hourly urine output. I also wanted an uncontaminated specimen to better allow me to evaluate the urine for evidence of blood or infection. I wanted a complete metabolic profile, including electrolytes, to make sure that with her dehydration she wasn't getting too far off track with her sodium potassium. I wanted liver enzymes to rule out liver involvement in her pain, a BUN and creatinine to nail down current renal function in light of her flank pain. I ordered an amylase and lipase to close the door on pancreatitis. I ordered an unprepped CT scan of her abdomen. We often hesitate to get CT scans on pregnant women because of the relatively large amount of X-irradiation exposure of the fetus. But in this case, the risk of appendicitis rupture far outweighs the risk, very small, of X-ray exposure. The CT will also provide information on the gallbladder, kidneys, and ureters. It's very useful in diagnosing abdominal pain, and I felt it was warranted in this case. We sometimes use ultrasound to help us with the diagnosis, particularly in the first and second trimesters where it has fair reliability, but ultrasound only infrequently can identify appendicitis with certainty in the third trimester. MRI would be another possibility, but MRI would not become available for another 8 hours, and I was uncomfortable waiting so long in a patient who was already quite ill. I started antibiotics, IV ampicillin and gentamicin, based on her serious illness, fever, leukocytosis, and high probability of bacterial infection, if not in her appendix, then in her kidney. I could stop the antibiotics later if I found them to be unnecessary. I gave her a bolus of 1 liter of lactated ringers to start to overcome her dehydration. I did nothing special for the fetus other than continuing to monitor its condition. While the fetal heart rate was a little high at 155, I could explain that on the basis of maternal fever. I was encouraged that despite the regular uterine contractions, there were no late decelerations, suggesting a reasonably good fetal condition. The cathed urine showed no blood and no white blood cells, effectively ruling out a renal stone. The electrolytes were normal, the liver enzymes were normal, and the creatinine was normal. Her BUN was slightly elevated, probably representing her state of dehydration. Her lipase and amylase were normal. The CT scan confirmed appendicitis, ruled out cholelithiasis and cholecystitis, and found no abnormalities in the kidneys or their collecting system. I called on general surgery to assist me. She needed an appendectomy relatively soon, but at 37 weeks, the uterus is so large that it would certainly interfere with access to the appendix, regardless of whether the surgeon was contemplating an open laparotomy or a laparoscopic approach. She was close enough to full term that my judgment was to first deliver her, getting the uterus out of the way, and then allow the surgeons to remove the appendix. Usually with appendicitis during pregnancy, it's not necessary to empty the uterus, as the surgeons can work around it. But this uterus was so large that I felt we had to deliver her. In a different set of clinical circumstances, I might have considered inducing labor, but with a very unfavorable cervix, I decided to proceed with cesarean section. As soon as the baby was out and the uterus closed, the surgeon stepped in, found the appendix, and removed it. It had not ruptured. Appendicitis occurs as frequently among pregnant women as it does when they are not pregnant, but can be much more difficult to diagnose. As pregnancy advances, the appendix moves from its usual location, becoming an upper abdominal structure around the 20th week of pregnancy. In diagnosing appendicitis, we often look for a mild fever and leukocytosis, but during pregnancy, many patients normally have a mild temperature elevation and leukocytosis. Rebound tenderness and abdominal rigidity is less often seen during the later stages of pregnancy with appendicitis. As a consequence of these difficulties, about 3/4 of appendectomies during the third trimester occur after rupture.